90.5 WKAR. Welcome to Current State for Tuesday, May 13th, 2014. I'm Mark Bayshore. Later this hour, we visit with an MSU researcher who is part of a really significant effort up until recently to track down the environmental factors that may determine the long-term health of young people. This was a study that focused on Wayne County here, and unfortunately, the National Institutes of Health pulled the funding for the project. So they're trying to put the pieces back together for the study and salvage something from it. Dr. Nigel Paneth, a professor of epidemiology, biostatistics, and pediatrics here at MSU, joins us in a little bit. We'll check in with the Detroit News Chad Livengood for a Detroit bankruptcy hearing update. As well, something is happening virtually every day in the city of Detroit involving the bankruptcy. We hope you can stay with us today. At the top of our program, authorities have charged a man who is suspected in the shooting deaths of two people yesterday, one in Lansing Township and the other in East Lansing. Only about 15 minutes separated the attacks. The first took the life of a 35-year-old man who worked at a Rite Aid pharmacy on East Saginaw near Frandor. The second killed another man at a nearby duplex on Coolidge Road in East Lansing. For more, we turn to the Lansing State Journal's Kevin Grasha, who's been reporting on the story. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark.
How much more do we know today about either the alleged shooter or the victims?
Yeah, we still don't know much. Police have not released any names. We did last night speak with a friend of the victim on Coolidge Road, who gave us a little bit more information. The friend said he's a 27-year-old person, and he's engaged with a child. We don't know anything more about the Rite Aid employee other than, as you said, he's a 35-year-old man. And the suspect as well, we just know that he's a young man, and apparently police are going to give us some more information today at the news conference.
And when is that? Where and when is the news conference?
Yeah, the news conference is at 11 at the Lansing Police Department's central headquarters downtown.
And briefly, how have police described what happened so far?
Basically, you know, what we've put together is that the first shooting happened, the suspect walks into the Rite Aid, confronts the employee who may have been a pharmacist, takes that person into a separate room, and then multiple shots are fired. The suspect then left Rite Aid, and as you said, 15 minutes later, goes back to where he lives on Coolidge Road. He lives in a duplex on Coolidge Road, and shoots another man multiple times as well.
And have you learned anything regarding a motive for the shootings?
My understanding is police are still, you know, putting that together as well, although I suspect they know more than what they've told us. There was a vague statement made yesterday that these weren't random acts. I never know what exactly that means, but I think that would indicate that the shooter knew his victims. And clearly, if it's a neighbor, he knows his neighbor.
You also wrote, you and Matt Miller for the Journal wrote yesterday about the reports of neighbors in the Coolidge Avenue duplex who reported loud arguments nearby involving the suspect, I take it.
Yeah, that's the one piece of information we do have is that Sunday night, specifically, there was a extremely long and loud argument that multiple people heard between who we believe is the suspect and a neighbor, and then possibly also a girlfriend. The neighbor was heard shouting at the suspect, you know, why don't you come over here and shoot me then? We don't know if that's the same person who got shot, but that is a piece of information that we do have now.
Mm. The suspect was apprehended after a two-hour standoff at this duplex on Coolidge Road in East Lansing. Were authorities communicating with the suspect during the standoff? And if so, how?
As far as I know, we're not sure how they were communicating with him for the first hour or so, but towards the end, they drove an armored vehicle up to the house and broke through a window. There was a window already broken, I don't know, and tossed in a cell phone to him. And it was definitely that cell phone that they used to talk to him towards the end of the standoff, and apparently they were able to talk to him, convince him to come out peacefully, because he did.
Mm-hmm. quite a few people in that neighborhood in East Lansing schools and elsewhere were subject to lockdowns after this was reported. Do you know how long those lockdowns lasted?
Yeah, there was several lockdowns. About three Lansing schools were locked down for about an hour. Initially, there were a couple of East Lansing schools that were locked down, but then we got word that all East Lansing schools were locked down for about 2 to 3 hours.
Okay. And did the lockdowns impact a lot of people who were not, you know, in schools?
Other than just the students, and you know, when there's a lockdown at a school, a lot of times the students don't even know that that's happening. It's kind of kept quiet, and I haven't spoken to anyone who's inside one of the schools, so I don't know exactly. But it was a couple hour process in East Lansing.
Okay, we want to thank the Lansing State Journal's Kevin Grasha, who has been reporting on the shootings that took place yesterday, one in Lansing Township, the other in East Lansing, and apparently 11 o'clock today, authorities do plan a press conference to presumably share more information with us. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. In the era of Obamacare, we often hear of healthcare delivery. That refers to the various ways patients are served by health professionals. For example, primary care from a general practitioner, secondary care at a hospital, urgent care, and so on. Many of the top policymakers and administrators in Michigan's healthcare system gathered yesterday here in East Lansing. They discussed a key issue involving all of us, the transformation of this vast delivery system in order to accommodate considerable costs and millions of newly insured Americans. Yesterday, I sat down with two key participants in the annual Michigan Health Policy Forum. First, Mr. Michael Levitt, the co-chair of the State Healthcare Cost Containment Commission, the former director of the U.S. Health and Human Services Administration under President George W. Bush, and the former governor of Utah. We were joined by the director of the Michigan Department of Community Health, James Haveman. I began by asking about a recent Cost Containment Commission report. It's called Cracking the Code on Healthcare Costs. It states the goal is, quoting now, to replace the nation's reliance on fragmented fee-for-service care with comprehensive coordinated care using payment models that hold organizations accountable for cost control and quality gains, unquote. I asked Governor Levitt how much of a consensus there is over coordinated care as a goal.
I don't think we can say there's a clear consensus. I think policymakers see the value of it, but the transition in the way we pay and who takes risk both require substantial changes. And there's a resistance to the change, and in some respects, we're not fully ready for it. But in terms of direction, I think there's a growing view that in order to bend the cost curve to give people better care at lower costs, we have to integrate the care better, and we have to change the system in a way that will produce that.
Tell us a little bit more about the nature of this resistance, though. Where is it coming from? What's it about?
Well, if you run a hospital or a doctor's clinic, you've been paid one way forever. You get paid on what's known as a fee-for-service basis. It's a piecemeal, and people have become very comfortable with it. Once you begin to say, we're going to pay you differently, we're going to require that you make some decisions and set some priorities, those are hard decisions. And it just takes time for people to understand how to do it. Now, there are segments of the population where that's been done well. I think here in Michigan, the Medicaid system is, for the most part, paid for on a capitated basis. That is to say, they give a healthcare provider or integrator a lump sum of money, and then their job is to keep people healthy and to keep them happy. And if they are able to do that for less money, then they benefit. In my mind, that's a very enlightened way to go. And And so in the entire Medicaid population here in Michigan, that's begun to move forward. But it's not true across the board.
Director Haveman, back in March on this program, Andy Hetzel, who's a spokesman for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, told our listeners that his organization has, in recent years, been moving away from the fee-for-service model toward better coordinated care with a number of what he called progressive hospitals across Michigan. How far down this road are we right now in Michigan, and how much further do we have to go?
Well, as Governor Leavitt said, way back in 1997, we moved over 800,000 people from fee-for-service to more of a managed care model, which is per member per month, which is a shared risk. That has continued, and as you know, with the Healthy Michigan Plan, which we unfolded in the state on April 1, it is very much that it's focused on outcome. It's focused on engagement of the consumer in their own care. It's focusing on chronic illness. I mean, we've talked before, Mark, that 77% of the healthcare costs in this state are related to chronic illness. Much of that's preventable. And the way you get a hold of that is a more organized approach to healthcare. And in Governor Leavitt's report on doubling down on healthcare cost containment, it really speaks to accountable care, integrated care organizations, more of a regional approach, to more of a capitated system, more of shared risk, more of the big thing we're going to be seeing in the years ahead is self-management, is consumer engagement in their own wellness. And this is something that we support and embrace.
Could I make the point that this is a bit more complicated than to simply say the insurance companies are now assuming or receiving a lump sum of money? Many of the insurance companies are receiving a lump sum of money in order to manage this population, but they're still paying the hospitals and doctors on a fee-for-service basis. So the payer of the state or the employer might be putting it out, but in many cases, the decision makers are the insurers as opposed to the care providers. And ultimately, to have coordinated care, you have to put both the care provider and the insurance company in essentially the same boat.
Well, as you pointed out, Governor Leavitt, hospitals are having to let go of an existing profitable model. What about that other side of the equation? Is there a shortage of insurers that are slow to embark on this transformation?
Insurers are more rapidly embracing it. In fact, they've been anxious to promote it for years. The shortage is in hospitals and clinics and others who are prepared to begin to change their model.
Before we get into some of the specific recommendations of the Cost Containment Commission's report, let's listen to a little of what Andy Hetzel had to say about how Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, for one, claims to be helping to drive this transformation in terms of better coordinated care. Here's his example.
For instance, we all know the circumstance of going into the doctor's office and having a test done, and then being admitted to the hospital, and once we get there, having the same test done at the hospital. By enabling doctors and hospitals to share information better, creating all patient registries, for example, we can eliminate the need to do that second test and save the money and treat the patient in the hospital system much more efficiently. And by eliminating that cost and sharing the savings back to the hospital, what Blue Cross is trying to do is to enable more efficient care, higher quality of care, savings, and a different form of reimbursement that really gives these hospitals the infrastructure funding they need to make these changes.
This gets to technology infrastructure. How big a piece is that in this larger transformation?
Well, Jim, I would say that it is a significant piece, but it's not the only piece. Right. To a large extent, I mean, someone once said to me, do you know what the most expensive piece of equipment is in a hospital? And I was thinking MRI or something, and they said, no, it's a ballpoint pen in the hand of a doctor. they make decisions on care that drive costs or that save cost. And right now, they are incentivized to have more care, as are, frankly, hospitals, because that test that was just spoken of, that was done twice, the hospital is part of their revenue model. It's, as they say, one man's waste is another man's living. And that's the dilemma, is getting people integrated so that they both have the same incentives, and it's keeping the patient healthy.
I was talking to a hospital administrator the other day, and he was saying that he's going through a whole transition in his own way of thinking as a hospital administrator, because in the past, hospital administrators would be kind of rewarded for keeping the hospital beds full. Now, with all the transformation that's going on in healthcare through the Affordable Care Act and almost a natural evolution of a lot of new ideas, they're going to get being paid for keeping hospital beds empty. So the future, I think the governor's report is really focused, and what we're doing here in Michigan is the primary healthcare consumer relationship, this whole, you're hearing more about navigators, the experience of care, population health, how does public health and Medicaid and how does this all come together where you have positive outcomes for people in their own wellness? Many times people talk about medical homes. Lately, I've been kind of using the theme, Governor, that the community you live in is your medical home. It means to do, are there bike paths? Are there healthy alternatives? Are there healthy places for kids to play? Are there?
What do you make of that, Governor Leavitt?
I absolutely believe it's true. If you were to look at the history of healthcare in our country and start looking at the place where we really started to make progress in, say, in mortality, it was where we began to pay attention to environmental factors, clean water, clean air, exercise, physical education. All of those things contributed to a dramatic increase in lifespan. And they will also contribute to short lifespan if we don't pay attention to them.
Our guest today on Current State, Governor Michael Leavitt and Director James Haveman of the Michigan Department of Community Health. We are talking about cost containment in health care. Governor Leavitt, let's touch on a few of your commission's specific recommendations, which you're addressing here at the East Lansing Conference. There are seven overall. The first one gets back to what we were just talking about. Create an alliance of stakeholders to transform the healthcare system. I take it reform of this magnitude may be impossible without such an alliance.
This requires enormous collaborative IQ. No individual person, organization, or even government can solve this. This requires a community collaborating, and that means you have to have conveners, someone who can bring the community together. It means you obviously have to have committed leaders who will continue to drive it forward when it gets hard. It means that you have to have all the right people at the table. This is serious change, and it requires not just change in laws, it requires changes in behavior.
And Director Haveman, how would you say we're doing on this front in Michigan?
Well, we just completed a process called the Blueprint for Health Innovation. It's part of a federal initiative on state innovation models, and this now at the federal government to review to do some test regions, and it did that exactly. For a year, we just spent time talking to stakeholders, consumers, hospital people, insurance companies, had a variety of hearings around the state, and really came up with, and it's amazing, many of the recommendations that we sent on to the federal government, CMS within HHS, were very similar to what the governor recommended in his report. And so that's why I'm excited about him being here today, because one of the follow-ups presentation to his presentation will be about the blueprint for the future.
Another recommendation, define and collect data to create a profile of healthcare in the state. This sounds daunting, candidly.
Well, until you can measure it, you can't make progress on it. And it does require some authoritative group to establish a baseline and say, this is where we start. And here's how we'll make progress. And you have to break it down into pieces. It sounds as though that's a lot of what Michigan has been doing and making good progress. And the more I learn about what Michigan's doing, the more encouraged I am that this is, in fact, a very good example of the kinds of things I wish other states were doing.
James Haveman, comment on that, if you would. How are we doing on the data front here in Michigan?
And data analytics are going to drive the future here with the medical files, which physicians are using, with the data systems that are going on a regional basis, with these hubs to transfer data. We have a data warehouse at the state of Michigan where we can query information of all our claims data. I can tell you now where the high utilizers are, where our hot spots are, where we can move programs to. This wasn't available, Mark, 15 years ago, 12 years ago. This is the new trend. This is an exciting part of why the governor and I see that there's hope, because we're going to have the data to make decisions on, and historically it wasn't made on data.
In very practical ways, this can be even predictive. When airlines deal with airplanes, they're able, through predictive analytics, to determine when a part needs to be replaced. It's a preventative maintenance at that point. We're now getting good enough at this that we're able to determine when people are about to have incidents in their life based on their behaviors, based on various things that have occurred. And having that kind of information not only saves money, it saves lives.
James Haveman, as we said, there are 7 key recommendations in this report. Do you agree with all of them, or are there any that you feel are wide of the mark or significantly less relevant or important than others?
I told the governor before we went on the air that I had read the report, and I really appreciate it. I thought they really captured in an understandable way a roadmap that people can really focus in on their recommendations. I think we, somewhat parallel, somewhat separate for what he has done, have really adopted many of those recommendations and where we're going forward in this day.
Recommendation number 3, establish statewide baselines for goals for health care spending, quality, and other measures as appropriate. Tell us more about that, Governor.
As I said just a bit earlier, if you can't measure it, it's hard to make progress. You get progress on what you inspect, not what you expect. So having a baseline to say, this is where we are today, and tomorrow we want to be at this place. We want to be able to have with some clear, measurable goals. And this requires leadership. I noted that Governor Snyder, as part of the agenda that he put forward in reinventing Michigan, was reinventing the healthcare system. Part of that is defining the deficiencies and setting clear goals on how to improve it.
Your report stresses the role of the states in this transformation. How is it individual states have so much leverage on this front?
I think you have struck at what the major point of this report is. States have more capacity to make a difference than you think. In fact, when you begin to look at the different ways in which states can impact healthcare, in many ways, it's substantially greater than the federal government, though all of the attention is paid to Congress. For example, the state has Medicaid. One of the largest payers in the state is Medicaid. When Medicaid puts the strength of its wallet behind change, it drives it. State employees, likely the largest employer in the state. You took the state's universities in there, and schools and cities and counties, and if they were to collaboratively come together to say, we're going to begin to drive payment change, it would occur. On top of just the impact of the wallet, being able to, the delivery system, there are certain coverage mandates that some states have that are illogical. The malpractice and tort reform is another area that the states control. The scope of practice, who can do what? Many states restrict the ability of people who are not doctors to do things that they can do quite well under the supervision of a doctor, much less expensively. All of those are the kinds of things that states control that Congress doesn't. Plus, there's an atmosphere of collaboration that can occur in a state because you're dealing with people who actually do things, not just people who talk about things.
James Haveman, do you feel as empowered as Mr. Leavitt suggests you should feel?
I've always been a state rights person, and we're a laboratory of innovation. In fact, it's really been fun for me to get together with some of my colleagues from Arkansas and Ohio and some of the other states who are thinking through similar things but have a different twist on them, and we can do some lessons learned together. But I think the states, and I think the governor's right, and that's why with the Healthy Michigan Plan, you know, there are many innovations, you know, and we needed a waiver to kick it off, as you know. We got another waiver coming up after 48 months. A person can choose to go to the exchange or stay on the plan with some increased premium. I mean, we're looking at some new ways of delivering health care to the adults, which is really focused on accountability for their own behavior. In fact, if you don't work on your wellness incentives with your health professional, you're not going to get a deduction in your premium, and you're going to be held accountable for it. And I think that's what's going to start changing the cost curve in this state.
Governor Leavitt, the wording of your commission's report, cracking the code, suggests a breakthrough. Is that reading too much into it, or do you consider what you found a breakthrough?
I feel more optimistic right now about the U.S. health system actually devising an American, uniquely American way to deal with health care than I have in 10 years. It has very little to do with the Affordable Care Act. I think it has to do with the fact that states and employers are beginning to feel very strong economic pressures to make changes. And we're starting to see very difficult things being undertaken. And it will take difficult change in order to solve this problem.
I said in this program before, about 12 years ago, I gave a speech where with the business people, where 95% of the businessmen in the room thought they had no impact on health care costs in their companies. Today, about 6 months ago, I gave the same speech. 99% of them now believe that they can do something about the health care costs with benchmarking and a whole lot of other expectations. And I agree with the governor. I think we're probably in a time where a lot of the legacy thinking, there's a lot of innovation going on. And, you know, you look at Ascension and Trinity Systems coming together with a new model that is more focused on patient care and high touch. You've got mergers of hospitals going on in the state. I think we're going to see this around the country. And I think we got to keep some competition going, and I think we'll have that. But I bet you within this state, within 5-6 years, we'll have maybe 5 large health systems basically offering the health care services to the citizens of the state.
And nationally, we're actually starting to see the cost curve bend. Now, there's lots of folks who'd like to take credit for that. But the reality is, it's the composite of millions of individual decisions being driven by financial requirement to survive. There is an economic imperative to this, that if the United States wants to stay competitive in the world, we have to do this better. We cannot allow 20-25% of our entire gross domestic product to go to health care. That means that education is being shortchanged. It means that research and development's being shortchanged. It means our infrastructure's going without. We have to do this better. We spend more than twice as much as the average developed nation on health care.
We've been talking mostly about the state dynamic here, but I've got to ask you about Sylvia Matthews-Burwell. She appears to be en route to appointment to your former job as director of HHS. Are you following this closely enough to comment on Ms. Burwell?
I am following her appointment and her confirmation closely. I don't know her. I hear very complimentary things being said by both Republicans and Democrats. She has a budget background. I think she's coming out of the Office of Management and Budget, which is a highly disciplined place. She has a big job. People have asked if I have advice for her, and I have just suggested that while the Affordable Care Act is a very important part of that job, there's a lot of things that happen in that department that she'll have to be paying attention to, and it'd be in her interest to look after all of them, not just one.
James Haven, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about community mental health centers across the state and their funding concerns. Virtually all of them are worried that there won't be enough new Healthy Michigan dollars coming in to offset the loss of money from the state's general fund. Where does that stand?
There's more money in the budget in 2014 than there was in the original 2014 budget for community mental health. most community mental health boards in the state have their consumers who make less than 138% of poverty. All of those are eligible for the Healthy Michigan Plan. Many of them already were on Medicaid because they were disabled and were part of the waiver program. We're watching it closely. We put more money out to the community mental health boards in April than we did in March, and we're monitoring this closely. A few have raised some concerns, but part of those have to do with counties that had shifted county responsibility to the community mental health boards and not away from the person who it should be going to. And I think it'll sort itself out over the next months, and I think we'll be going into next fiscal year in a robust way.
I think you're probably referring to a $12 million supplemental that went to help with this recently. We spoke with Tom Watkins, president of the Detroit Wayne County CMH Authority, and he told us he had to cut $20 million alone just from his budget. That's just for Wayne County. Certainly $12 million isn't going to go anywhere near covering the kinds of cuts. If many other counties have to make comparable cuts, it's not going to do an awful lot.
Well, Wayne County is unique because, as you know, Detroit Wayne just became an authority, and they split from the county of Wayne, but some of the county of Wayne responsibilities went with the authority and should have stayed with the county of Wayne. And I think Tom's going to have to work that out with the county executive.
I know you rely more on Medicaid expansion here to cover some of these costs, but there are crucial programs in mental health in particular that are not covered by Medicaid, correct?
Some, but there's some general fund dollars out there yet. You know, they're not all gone, and folks are going to have to learn. We're moving to an arena that is more focused on person care and less on administration. I mean, we have to cut out some administrative costs, and we have to look at programs that are working and what's not working. And there were many things in some of the community mental health boards over the state that I think it's good that they're just stepping back and saying, okay, is this a program that we want to continue, or is this somebody else's responsibility? We're moving to an integration, the whole carve-out of mental health from physical health. We are integrating health so fast in this country, we can hardly keep up with the coding and the policies. And the community mental health boards that understand that are doing just fine. And we're getting a few complaints, but it isn't statewide.
If the Healthy Michigan dollars turn out not to be enough, can the state make up the difference? Will the state make up the difference?
The fact that we're at 237,000 people today after 5 weeks of introducing a Healthy Michigan Plan program, where most of those who are part of the Community Mental Health Board are eligible for if they currently don't have Medicaid, I assure you there'll be plenty of dollars to serve the people in this state.
You can guarantee that?
Sure. Yeah. Very confident.
Where's the legislature on that?
Legislature is moving ahead to finalize our 2015 budget at this time. And there's no rumblings within the legislature to add additional dollars in the community mental health line.
Michigan Department of Community Health Director James Haveman there. We were also joined by Governor Michael Leavitt. Both participated in yesterday's Michigan Health Policy Forum in East Lansing. Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Yesterday marked the deadline for objections to Detroit's plan of adjustment as a result of the city's bankruptcy. Over a dozen criticisms were registered by residents, creditors, and even the federal government. Detroit News reporter Chad Livengood joins us now to break down what these objections mean, to give us an update on the bankruptcy hearing, along with the package of Detroit centric bills that Michigan lawmakers are currently considering. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you back. You are covering, we'll start with your activities here throughout the day on Tuesday. You're covering the visit of Emergency Manager Kevin Orr at the state capitol. What is happening there?
Well, Kevin Orr will be in the capitol for his first appearance before a legislative committee, a special committee formed in the House to handle Detroit bankruptcy legislation related to the so-called grand bargain for essentially trying to rescue the Detroit Institute of Arts from having its artwork sold off in exchange for bolstering the city's pensions. And the state has got legislation now that would appropriate $195 million up front towards this this pension aid, and so Kevin Orr is going to be at the Capitol today talking about the need for this for the state's participation in this settlement in order to get the wide-ranging number of retiree groups on board with resolving this bankruptcy consensually.
And does this plan, as it currently exists, Chad, how much support does it enjoy from the legislature generally? Is that apparent?
It's not quite apparent yet. One thing that has really kind of come to light in the last couple of days is when this legislation was introduced late Thursday afternoon before lawmakers took off for the rest of the week last week. The bills the strings attached to the money don't match the plan of adjustment that's currently before pensioners and creditors in the city of Detroit. And recall, there's a lot of fast-moving parts. Yesterday, the city began mailing out 67,000 ballots and solicitation packets to creditors who are eligible to vote, including 32,000 pensioners strung out all across the country. And the problem right now that's kind of arised is that some of the demands from the legislature do not fit the deals that were hatched with the labor unions and with the pension funds. This legislature, for example, is calling for the end of any kind of defined benefit pension after new labor contracts expire in 5 years. They're also calling for the end of any future retiree health insurance for current workers after next year. And those are not deals that that the labor unions bargained for, and it's not deals that the pension funds agreed to, and that the retiree associations agreed to. So even though you had this, 5-6 months of closed door, intense mediation and negotiations, now the legislature has its chance to try to put its imprint on it, and that has a possibility of changing the terms of the bargain.
And you expect those topics to come up today, correct?
I would, yeah. The Kevin Orr is going to have to address it. He has said that he thinks that he's in favor of some type of a pension. What they have in the plan right now is what they call a hybrid pension, where an employee has to make a defined contribution of some sort, a certain small percentage of their check towards their retirement, and then they do still get a defined benefit, although it's not as generous as the previous pension plan. But that way you have people paying into the pension fund still for the next 40 years. See, all these lower pension cuts that they have been able to come up with assume people, employees in the city, continue to pay into the pension fund into the future. And if you take that away, then you require 401k, then it's going to require a lot more higher upfront cost to transition to 401k, which the state of Michigan realized when they went to 401k in 1997. And the state of Michigan also realized in 2012 when they flirted with sending all the state's teachers into 401k, and they ultimately decided not to do that because of the immense cost up front.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with the Detroit News, Chad Livengood, with a Detroit bankruptcy update. Kevin Orr will be at the state capitol here today. We mentioned some of the objections put forth yesterday to the city's plan of adjustment from various parties, the federal government and others. But late last night, I guess another objection unfolded from the DIA. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, the Detroit Institute of Arts is objecting to an effort by a couple of the city's bond insurers. One's called Financial Guarantee Insurance Corporation, which is about on the hook for about $1.1 billion in Detroit debt that they could face losses on. And another company called Syncora Guarantee, which has several hundred million dollars of liability exposure. They are leading an effort to let outside interested bidders come into the DIA and inspect a limited number of art pieces of art, 3,000 approximately, and submit their own bids to as counter proposals to the grand bargain. So the grand bargain is an $816 million pool of money from 12 foundations, the state of Michigan, if the legislature comes through, and the DIA has pledged to have its donors come up with $100 million of that $816. And these bond insurers contend that there's more money to be had out of the DIA, that there's more value there than $816 million. They've got some preliminary bids that were up to a $2 billion loan against the collateral of the art, and some other interested buyers, that submitted bids last month that got revealed that were, north of $1 billion. So they're trying to get solid bid numbers so that when this thing goes to trial in July, they can come into court and say, tell the judge, look, the city hasn't done its due diligence on all of its assets. There's more money to be had. There's a better bargain out there, essentially, for that's more fair to the creditors. Because at the end of the day, when this debt cutting plan is put on trial, it has to be feasible and it has to be fair and equitable to creditors. And if you got some bond insurers who are getting nearly wiped out, and you got pensioners who are walking away, nearly unscathed, like the police and firefighters are, there's going to be an argument that's not fair to the bondholders, to the investment firms and global banks that essentially propped up Detroit's finances for the last decade.
When you add up all these objections, Chad, it sounds like a lot of objections from the federal government, from counties, from all kinds of creditors. How hard will it be for these objections to be overcome?
Well, I mean, the city's going to have to prove that it's done all it can to meet the requirements of bankruptcy. The county objections all deal with the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department and some of the finances and assumptions made there, because they're the recipients of that water, and so it's you get to be seen. The DIA, they are essentially arguing that if you let these outside entities come in and pull paintings off the wall, it, quote, invites disaster. And they're essentially arguing that this rushed attempt to appraise it, which they call it a yard sale-like physical inspections, is not necessary, and that they are, they're contending that they're providing enough documentation. And so we'll have to see where the judge comes down on that. He already has signaled to the city that he wants to see the water department spun off into a regional authority. And if the city can't come up with that way to do that and get an agreement with Oakland and Macomb County and Wayne County, then that will be a significant problem for the city to get out of bankruptcy.
Chad, we're just about out of time. Real briefly, have you been talking to many pensioners about the voting process the next couple of months? Generally, what are you hearing?
Well, they're not looking forward to this packet of information that's coming, and some of them it's a lot more difficult for general retirees. They have varying different degrees of cuts, and so they're trying to assess what's best at this point, with a lot of information flying out there and a lot of at times mixed signals coming from both their leadership and also from the city of Detroit. So
okay.
It is going to be a tough slog here to the end of July 11th is the end of voting.
Chad Livengood covers the Detroit bankruptcy and related topics for the Detroit News. Chad, many thanks for the insights.
Thanks for having me.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. In 2011, Michigan State University embarked on a national project to study the impact of the environment on the health of children from birth to age 21. The National Children's Study was designed to be the largest such research of its kind. MSU was part of a statewide team that interviewed more than 100 pregnant women in Wayne County. They were in search of data that might determine their children's long-term health outcomes. However, the National Institutes of Health pulled the funding for the project. Now, the Michigan team is hoping to continue its work in a scaled-down form. Joining me to talk about the aftermath of the National Children's Study is Dr. Nigel Paneth, University Distinguished Professor of Epidemiology and Biostatistics and Pediatrics here at Michigan State University. Dr. Paneth, welcome to Current State.
Good to be here, Mark.
You began work on this study more than 3 years ago. It was meant to be a really ambitious project focusing on Wayne County residents to study how genetics and physical and social environments affect the health of children. Explain the framework a little bit more for it, your methodology.
Well, the concept underlying the National Children's Study is that if we start early enough in life to examine the environment, and I mean starting early in pregnancy, mm-hmm. before a child is born, and really assess the environment carefully, the mother's environment, in every sense of the word environment, not just the chemical environment we sometimes use to think about, but the social, psychological, nutritional, infectious environment, we might get answers to some of the very pressing child health problems that we haven't solved. It should be remembered that infant mortality has declined a lot in recent years, but not because we have discovered anything about the causes of infant mortality. We've just been better able to treat them. Prematurity is at about the same rate it's been for the last 40 or 50 years. Birth defects, with one notable exception, are at the same rate. These are the major contributors to infant mortality. The severe neurodevelopmental disorders, cerebral palsy, mental retardation, we now call cognitive deficiency, autism, seizure disorders, are all at the same rates that they've been historically, or higher even. Mm. And we have not made the progress we need to make to understand what underlies these conditions so that we can prevent them. And a lot of us think the only way to go about that is to really learn about the environment that the infant exposed to from as early as we can, mm-hmm. from really the beginning of pregnancy. And the National Children's Study was an attempt to do that. Unfortunately, the administrative task proved too complex, I guess, for the National Institutes of Health, and they're redesigning the study as we speak. There will be a report on the new design to be issued by the Institute of Medicine next month, and we will then find out what the future of the National Children's Study is. In the meantime, those 40 centers around the country that had local contracts to conduct the research, including ours, have been they came to an end, and they were not renewed. And
how far did you feel you got with this?
Not very far, to be honest. We had hoped to enroll 5,000 children in Michigan. As it turns out, we enrolled 116 mothers.
Ooh.
So not quite all the way there, but this reflected the conditions we had to work in.
And what was the problem from the NIH's point of view? You referred to an administrative problem or what?
It's a very complex story that is would be complex to get into here. But I did. Write something about this in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2013 in a commentary. The job of managing a study of this magnitude is no easy thing, and I think it needed a lot more expertise and thought out designs than in fact occurred, and we'll see what happens.
Another report is due out relatively soon from the Institute of Medicine.
Yeah, the Institute of Medicine has been a Congress recognizing the difficulties that were occurring, insisted that the redesign that NIH has come up with be subject to a careful review by the Institute of Medicine. And the Institute of Medicine will provide that review we anticipate next month in June. It will appear, and we will see what the Institute of Medicine thinks of the current design of the children's study. To be perfectly honest, I'm not very happy with the current redesign, but to some extent it's not really fleshed out enough to comment on fully. But we will see what happens. In the meantime, I'd rather talk about what we're doing in Michigan.
Tell us about that.
Then put it on a more positive spin on this, because what we learned from the children's study was that when we bring our institutions together, we really can do things that are amazing.
Now, which institutions are you referring to exactly?
Yeah, we decided early in the game that we would all work to, the five institutions would work together, the three large universities, Wayne State, the University of Michigan and Michigan State, the largest academic health center in our state, the Henry Ford Health System, which is one of the largest academic health centers in the country, and the fifth partner is the Michigan Department of Community Health. And the five of us together formed a committee and formed a steering committee, and we set out to conduct the study as best we could in Michigan. And I think what little we did very effectively, as effectively as anyone in the country. And we decided, after the NIH did not renew the children's study contracts around the country, to continue to work together. We thought we had something very strong, and that by working with the strengths of each institution, we could do more than any one institution could do.
How much has that taken shape?
Well, what we have is an organization which we, my colleague in the Department of Epidemiology, Gene Curver, named CHARM, Child Health Alliance for Research in Michigan. I think that's a really nice name for us. And we have a steering committee from the five institutions. And our goal is to think of ways to do on a smaller scale the kinds of ideas that the Children's Study was supposed to carry out. We certainly couldn't do things at the level of 100,000 people, which was the original plan for the children's study. But we could do something on the scale of several thousand individuals, and we could learn a great deal from that about the environmental causes of some important childhood disorders. We probably couldn't study the rarer disorders, but we could certainly study a lot of very important disorders that are such as asthma, such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, such as perhaps learning disabilities, any number of conditions that are quite frequent, and that we do think that if we had a better exploration of their antecedents before the onset of illness, starting with a healthy population, we could make some inroads into. And that is our mission, and we have already established some of these, what we call pregnancy cohorts in Michigan. We have one in Lansing, and there are others that have been established earlier. And we're beginning to assemble our thinking about this and to plan, ideally, some kind of a large study in Michigan that we would collaborate on that would get at some of the answers to these pressing questions that we haven't been able to answer.
All very interesting. We want to thank Dr. Nigel Paneth, who has been our guest on Current State, a university distinguished professor of epidemiology and biostatistics and pediatrics here at Michigan State University. Best of luck.
Thank you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State here every Tuesday as part of our partnership. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll learn about risk associated with ibuprofen, and we'll take a look at the history of tax cuts in Michigan. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Current State's executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our program's producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR.